Language can be used to connect people, but sometimes language rules can cause confusion and arguments, even among friends, family, and spouses. But help is on the way. Our next guest hit the road and traveled around the country, including here to Wisconsin, to set up a grammar table and answer questions from passerbys, or I guess passersby. She joins us now to share that experience and to tackle some of the funky twists and turns of spelling, punctuation, grammar, and more. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a nagging grammar question? Maybe a dispute you have with a friend or loved one? Is there something that you always stumble over when it comes to spelling something or how to write something or how to punctuate it? You name it. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ellen Jovan is the co-founder of a communication skills training consultancy called Syntaxis. She's the author of the new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. Ellen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob, for letting me take my grammar party inside on this hot day. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. How did you get started as a roving grammarian setting up your grammar advice table?
I wasn't that roving at first. At first, I like grammar, in case that isn't clear yet. And one day I said, hey, I need a grammar table. So I ordered a table, made a sign, and I walked outside my building. There's a little park right there. So I didn't even have to go a full block. And I put it down and I started answering questions. So I roved one block initially, but then I started moving further around the city and eventually around the country.
And people, you set up shop here with your table, and people, it seems like, were really interested. They came up and had conversations and questions and arguments they had on hand. People love to talk about this with you.
They really do. And to me, it's not surprising at all. Sometimes people say, who cares about grammar? No one cares about grammar anymore. And I'm thinking, you need to sit at the table with me for an hour, because people definitely care about it. They love talking about it. They love fake fighting about it. It can be really hilarious. It's this wonderful bonding instrument for conversation.
Let's get a taste of it. You shared an example with us from a grammar table interaction, this one in Milwaukee. So we can get a flavor of what's going on here. Here's a listen.
It's the grammar table. Do you have any grammar questions?
Yes. The use of commas. Spoke. Commas like to describe stuff, like more than one thing. Like,
if you have a list.
Dark brown hair, blue eyes, red lips, stuff like that.
That was very visually, I can't think of a word right now. You've left the grammar table speechless. So are you asking about the comma before the and, if it's a list of things?
No, how do we use more commas? We choose not to use commas at all, just a stream of consciousness.
Is this the collective familial we, or does we mean your kids?
My kids.
Sounds like this was a lot of fun. And I think a key, Ellen, is that you're not judgy about this at all, as far as I can tell. You wouldn't correct me and say, don't you mean judgmental, Rob?
I definitely wouldn't. I don't feel judgmental at all. I just think to me, this is really fun, and I'll just answer whatever question people have. I don't tackle them when they walk by. If I hear them use the wrong past participle, that's not how this works.
We're talking to Ellen Jovan, author of the new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. She brought her grammar table to almost every state in the country, including Wisconsin, to answer questions for people. And you can join in with your questions, your grammatical conflicts and confusions. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go to your calls now. Al is with us in Green Bay. Al, hello.
Thanks for taking my call. So my question involves the word unique. I was brought up to believe that unique means one of a kind. Therefore, you would never put a modifier with it. You wouldn't say somewhat unique or kind of unique, because unique means one of a kind. It doesn't mean kind of one of a kind. But in later years, I've had other people try to tell me that unique simply means unusual. What's the ruling?
Al, thanks for the call. Ellen, how unique does something have to be before we can call it unique?
There's so many things that I could say about this, Al. I personally do not modify my unique. I use it as an absolute. So something is unique or not. I think the word is kind of spoiled, because you know, people who promote things like to make things very unique, extremely unique. And after a while, it just stops having the zing that it, you know, for me, it doesn't have much zing anymore. But it is used also by people to mean unusual. And it definitely takes on that meaning for me when they put an adverb in front of it. I just don't happen to do it myself. So, Al, I have your back. I follow your ways. And, you know, the world changes around us, right?
Thanks for that call. And, you know, I always think of the United States Constitution. What are we going to create? A more perfect union, right? And some people, I think, to this day say, well, perfect, you're either perfect or you're not. And how do you get more perfect? But so this kind of question has been around a long time.
I mean, I think I kind of sympathize with the there can be a more perfect or more unique thing. Yeah, because if you have a tiny blue marble and then you have a somewhat like a twice as big blue marble next to it, you can say that, okay, in a collection of small marbles, that bigger blue one is unique. But what if you then have a green one that's 100 times as big? The gap between them is bigger. And I think that is captured by the language, even though people don't like it.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Lexi is with us in Elkhorn. Lexi, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the show. And I really love the title of the guest book. I just want to say that first. That's great. My question is about pleaded versus pled. Like, why do I hear on the radio he pleaded guilty? I think that's what I hear. And I want, like, my ear wants me to hear pled, like he pled guilty, but I don't hear people say that anymore. So I'm wondering what the difference is. And my ear just wants to hear that. It's a weird thing. Like, it hurts my ears when I hear pleaded guilty. And I also wanted to know how the guest became a grammar expert. That would be really interesting to me. And thank you.
Lexi, thanks for the call. Yeah, I think pled is right, but it's a really weird sound word, like pled. I don't know. Question, Ellen.
Yeah, so this is an example of the kind of thing that I bring out usage books for. You know, so when I set up the table, I always have this big pile of books, and I rely on Brian Garner's book, Garner's Modern English Usage for things like this, because he's a legal lexicographer. So may I just quote him briefly here for Lexi? Pleaded has always been the predominant past tense and past participial form. From the early 1600s, pleaded has appeared much more frequently in print sources than its rivals. Commentators on usage have long preferred it, pouring drops of vitriol onto has pled and has, oh, pled spelled E-A-D in that case. So my ear is used to pled, but, you know, this is one of the words actually that I have a little bit of an experiential gap between me and the usage experts on. And there's a whole bunch more on that I won't read to you, but it's more complicated often than people
Interesting.
Think.
Interesting.
And then there was a second part. Oh, how
did you
time?
Become a grammar expert? Yeah, okay. Just give a quick origin story, maybe.
Okay. Yeah. I have taught writing and grammar my entire life. I majored in language and literature types of things. So I have a degree in German and an MA in comparative literature. I have studied 25 languages, well, more than that on my own. And I'm sitting in front of a giant library of grammar books right now. So it's a lifelong obsession.
All right. Let's go back to our callers now. Thanks for that. Becky is with us in Rio. Becky, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the program. It's really interesting. So the word that hurts my ears is the plural of attorney general. I think it used to be attorney generals. Now I always hear attorneys general, and that just sounds awkward to me. Is that correct, or why has it changed?
Ooh, is it correct, and has it changed, Ellen?
I'm not aware of that having changed. I think I can't say for sure what the frequency is of the plural formations unless I go check a database for you. But I've always, my whole life, which has been a little bit, you know, it's longer than average for the planet now. I've always done attorneys general, and I suspect that you just hear both because people are doing both. That's how it often is with language. But I would do attorneys general.
Yeah, because in this case, you think general, oh, that's like a military rank, so you're like the attorney general. But actually, it's a general is a modifier of attorney. Like, you do lots of different stuff. So it's attorneys
exactly.
general. Did I
exactly.
get that right? Excellent.
Yeah, and I also say mothers-in-law.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I would too, For sure. Thanks. That's a great question at 800-642-1234. Let's go down to Bill in Milwaukee. Bill, hello.
Hello. I have a sentence for you. The Austrian crystal chandelier crashed to the floor below. Now, I was told that the names of countries are always adjectives, but in this one, it's an adverb. I've gotten in fights about this. What do you think?
Fights? Okay. Oh, okay. Oh, I get it. The distinction here is the chandelier Austrian, yeah, what, or is it a type of crystal called Austrian crystal?
Uh-huh. Bill, may I ask you, how did this even come up? Do you always parse sentences that you encounter?
I gave this to my students as a question on an exam. It was always fun to debate about it, but a guy in a bar really got mad. He said that the names of countries are always adjectives. I said that this one is describing an adjective, which makes it an adverb.
I don't know.
Austrian is an adverb.
I gotcha. Bill, I don't know how much time you've spent in Ellen, but we spent all our time getting into fist fights in bars over grammar and language. Basically,
wow,
do you have a ruling for Bill on this one?
Well, I suspect, you know, it's funny because I grew up with, you know, sort of traditional grammar. I suspect linguists would probably not categorize, I would have to check with my linguist friends. I think they would probably not categorize it as adverbial strictly, but I see the point. I'm going to have to think about that.
All right, Bill, thanks a lot. Keep it calm out there, man. We're talking with grammar and language expert Ellen Jovan about her experiences operating a public grammar advice table around the country. She shares the story in her new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something that's always nagged at you about grammar, spelling, punctuation, pronunciation? Do you have a pet peeve or you need something resolved? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Ellen Jovan about her new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. Let's go back to your many calls at 800-642-1234. We just heard about Austrian crystal. Now we'll go to Crystal Lake, Illinois with Carol. Carol, hi.
Hi, Rob. I can tell Ellen just loves her job just by that laugh. You can just tell. My query is about literally, and my beloved daughter uses it constantly, and I think, what does she mean? And then I'm seeing it written. A lot of people are using that now. What are they talking about?
Literally is literally everywhere, Ellen.
Don't start trouble here. Yeah, I mean, so when people say literally X happened and it didn't actually happen, it's a kind of hyperbolic statement. So I get it. Like I might say, oh my gosh, my head exploded when I heard that. And my head didn't actually explode. So I think that's kind of the idea behind the literally as non-literally supporting. That's that argument. I personally don't do that particular one. I exaggerate in many other ways.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Ellen, it seems like a lot of people have that pet peeve, that one or two or maybe 50 language things that bug them a lot.
It's true. And I actually think it serves various social functions that we probably can't quite grasp when we're busy arguing about them. I mean, so first of all, you often have peevers, like people who have peeves that they want to peeve about. And then you have peevers about peevers, who are the peevers who complain about the peevers. Well, no, they're not peevers. But they peeve about the peevers, which is a form of peeving. And it's kind of like this cycle. And it's sort of what I like about it is that even when people get annoyed, it doesn't usually come to fist fights. And I think there's a certain catharsis and a bonding thing in it, as long as it's not too mean. I don't like the mean-spirited peeving. Mm.
And we can say peever and peeving and to peeve.
I made up two words already this afternoon. So
yeah, I do it all the time too.
Ask if you want strict rules about that.
Thanks again for the call. Mike is with us next in Eau Claire. Hi, Mike.
All right. Thanks for taking my call. I have I guess, a pet peeve, too, when people say things like between you and I, and I know it should be between you and me. And I actually had a boss at work. I almost got into an argument with her, but I knew better, you know, than to try to argue with my boss about it. But I said between you and me, and, yeah, she corrected me. It's between you and I, Mike.
Uh-oh. So. Right. Mike, thanks a lot for that. It gets tricky, though, Ellen, because depending on where it is in a sense, like, you and I are having a conversation, but this land was made for you and me, and then we, I don't know, it's easy to start second-guessing you and
Rob,
me.
Rob, that was so beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
May I respond?
Yeah, yeah.
Comment? Do I have time?
Definitely. Oh, we got lots of time.
Okay. So I actually was in an interview. I teach grammar courses to adults. So I was in an interview with a company where I was going to teach grammar courses for their employees. This was almost 20 years ago. And I said, you can feel free to call Brant or me. That's my partner, or me. And then the person interviewing me asked about it because she thought it was wrong. And I explained it. And then I did not get that job. And the point of this is that there is grammar, and then there's the politics of grammar.
Oh, well, I hope you got a better job after that with somebody more grammatically understanding. Thanks again for calling Ellen and me. We'll go next to Becky in Whitefish Bay. Becky, hello.
Oh, hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. And I love this program. I love this topic right now. I have taught English language learners for almost 20 years. And the thing that gets to me is when people say conversate instead of converse. I've always thought it was converse, and I think that people say conversate maybe as default because of conversation.
Huh.
But that really irks me.
Becky, thanks. Ellen, I don't think I've encountered conversate all that often. Have you?
Oh, many, many times. It's really common. But, you know, I have talked to a lot of people
True.
About these things. Yeah, there are often coexisting forms of verbs, and some of them are more common, or of words generally, not just of verbs, and that some are more common in certain dialects than in others. So I hear that among some demographics and less among others. And I don't say it, but I've gotten used to it. And I think it's always when there's a clash in a word that we use a lot or hear a lot, there's always a little clash in our brain as we process it. So I just wish for peace for you.
Becky, thanks a lot for that call. I'm conversating with Ellen Jovin. Her new book is called Rebel with the Claws, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Katie is with us now in Eau Claire. Katie, hello.
Good afternoon. I have a question about the word memoir and when somebody has written a collection of their life stories, is it their memoirs or have they written a memoir?
Oh, they both sound vaguely right to me, Ellen. What's the deal?
You're the first person who's ever asked me about that.
Huh.
I wrote my memoir. I mean, I think my default is singular, but I would actually have to investigate the history of that one to be certain. I try to be very responsible in the information dispensed from the grammar table. So, by the way, Rob, I'm going to also be posting on my Twitter account about the Austrian crystal question, because I think traditional grammarians will say adverb and the not, and linguists will say something else. So I will also bring this one up there because this is fun for my grammar table language polls.
Excellent. All right. I will look for that later. Time for another call or two. Drew is with us in Grafton. Drew, hi. Are you there, Drew? Not hearing Drew. Let's try Victoria in Menominee. Victoria, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Victoria?
My biggest pet peeve is when people say axe instead of ask. I would just like to slap them.
Victoria, thanks for the call. Now, there are a lot of words where kind of vowel or consonants will flip-flop, like nuclear, axe instead of ask. What do you think about that one, Ellen?
Yeah, there's actually a long history for that kind of thing where you see that flipping. That's not an area of expertise for me. That's more a linguist's domain. I believe John McWhorter, the linguist, has written about that, but it actually goes back a lot longer than people think, and has affected language in more ways, I suspect, than we realize. It's also part of African American vernacular. So you might hear it more there. So it's also, you know, within certain groups, you hear certain things more than others. I grew up near the Valley in the 80s in Los Angeles. So there are things that I am doing right now that are probably annoying people, and they may write to me about it afterwards.
Thanks for the call, Victoria. Todd is with us now, calling from north of Toma. Todd, hello.
Hi there. I was calling about the terms data and datum. And data, to me, is a plural term, so the data are compelling. But I hear it actually on NPR a fair amount, where people use data as a singular.
Todd, great question. You cover this in the book, Ellen. I try to write around it, so I never say data is or data are. I just change the damn sentence. What do you think?
I love this topic. I love all the grammar topics that intersect a little bit with mathy kinds of things. I love that extra. Somehow I haven't noticed that catching on as much with some other people, but I love it. It came into English as a plural, and datum came in as the singular. But here's reality for me. I cannot remember ever in my life hearing someone say datum, except maybe in some kind of scientific analysis. Data is used as a plural countable noun, but it is also used as a synonym for information generally. So the further you are away from a quantitative analysis with data points, the more likely you are to hear it as a singular. And I consider both acceptable.
Thanks for everybody's calls. And Ellen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I loved it.
That's Ellen Jovin, author of the new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian.